Ladies and gentlemen, a truly scintillating program, the James Whale Radio Show. Right, here we are. Very good day to you, whether you're listening to us on radio, online, maybe on your iPad as you travel to work, or if you're like DJ Tony Fisher whilst you're walking. He always listens to this program whilst you're walking. Wherever you are in the world, welcome to the show. Later today, we will meet, and I don't think we've never had Rob. Are you there, Rob, are you?
Yeah, I'm here. Yes, yeah.
Oh, good, good, yeah. Rob produces the show. Anybody wants to get in touch with us, all you have to do is email us at jameswhaleradio@gmail.com.
That's right.
And Rob will reply, because he does for me. Rob is like, he does for me.
I'm a doer.
He does anything. He does anything I want, he does. Now, later on the program today, we're going to have a chat to one of my oldest friends, a legend. Lots of people have misconceived ideas about this man. His name is Peter Stringfellow. He is the flamboyant club owner, known perhaps now for his support of the Conservative Party and his lap dancing club or clubs in London. But he's a brilliant bloke. He's getting on a bit now, but he's just a nice guy. He is a nice chap. I'll tell you a little story, Rob, about that. Which I think I'll mention to him. Mrs. W used to take me to the club when I'd just come out of hospital after I'd had a kidney removed. And I don't know whether there are healing properties in a lap dancing club. Or maybe there are.
I'll give it a go.
Well, it's not a lap dance. Sorry, it's a pole dancing club. That's completely different when I think about it. But, Mrs. W used to want to get up and do a bit of pole dancing herself. And I said, no, at your age, you know, you don't want your hips going or something like that, really. So we sat and watched. But he's always been a brilliant guy. When I started the charity, you know, he came and launched it. And you remember when I started the TV show, James Whale Radio Show, on television?
Yeah.
Back in the, well, it was about 1990, wasn't it? I think it was 1990.
Yeah, late 80s.
The launch of that club. And that was before he turned the club into, it was just one of London's well-known nightclubs. That's where we had the launch party for the TV show. Golly, that's 25 years ago.
Yeah, a long time ago.
A long time ago. So anyway, listen, what's upsetting us this week and what's not? I'll tell you one thing that is annoying me this week, and that's the flipping bishops again. The bishops going on about democracy. Of course, religion is very democratic, isn't it? I don't know about you, but I wanted to have a go about that. I just think it's about time that we separated religion and politics in this country. I just do not see, and you know, get in touch, let me know if I'm wrong, you get in touch. I don't see any reason for a bunch of bishops who are not democratically elected by anyone and have a particular belief system that you and I and many, many other people in this country possibly do not share what they believe in, that they actually get to sit in the House of Lords. Now, I know nobody's elected in the House of Lords, but why should one religion rather than another religion or belief pattern be able to sit in? I mean, I'm a Aurelian bishop, for goodness sake, aren't I?
You are, yes.
You know, I was ordained by Rael, who, of course, is half man, half alien. His mother was, she fell in with an alien sometime, and he was the result. You know about the story of Rael. I won't go on about that, otherwise people might think I'm slightly bonkers. But anyway, I just think it's a thought. I think it's about time that religious leaders concentrated on trying to make all religious leaders, by the way, Muslims, Jews, Christians, the whole lot. I think the leadership should start talking out. At the moment, Muslim, well, they're not Muslims, are they? The nutters are getting the headlines. But, you know, from time to time, particularly in America, there are some fundamentalist Christians who've done appalling things. And from time to time, all religions seem to spawn followers who, and I'm sure they take it the wrong way and they go nuts. Although you go back to certain times in our history, and religious leaders of all walks of life were prepared to do completely disgusting things to people that they considered did not share their beliefs. So I think, you know, if religion wants to fit into the 21st century, maybe the leaders of religion should start talking out about the ones who get it wrong and start trying to promote violence and nastiness to everybody else. So anyway, that's one of the things I wanted to do on the show today. What did you want to do?
I wanted to listen to you.
Yes, I know. Actually, talking about politics, and we'll talk to Stringfellow about his thoughts on politics later as well. Do you think voting, I did ask this on Facebook, actually, do you think voting should be compulsory?
Yes, I do.
Why?
Well, because then it'd be a fair representation of the public, then, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I actually think it should. I think though, what should happen is you should have none of the above or none of these, so that people can have to cast their vote, but they don't necessarily have to vote. And if the winners are none of the above, if there are more people not happy about those people who put themselves forward to be our elected representatives, then we have to go back and we have to rerun it or look at it again. Not only that, I actually think there should be a limit on the amount of money that political parties should be allowed to spend on elections. I mean, there's a sort of limit, but and it should be a lot less than it is. I mean, I had to sit through a bloody party political broadcast the other night on television, and it doesn't matter which party it's from, but there are certain rules and regulations about advertising, and it seems that they don't apply to politicians and political parties, because this particular party political broadcast was, just talking complete and utter dogs. It really was. I mean, of course, vote for us and we will make sure, blah, blah, blah. Well, what they were offering was never going to happen. It was an impossibility. And they all seem to feel they can come on and they can tell us. First of all, they can lie to us about what they achieved when they were in power, because they always seem to slip their minds of all the things they got wrong and all the things they did that cost us fortunes. And then they tell you what they're going to do. And of course, any of them, you could say, well, when you were last in power, why didn't you do it then? So I think it should be compulsorily, you have to vote, but there should be one saying, you know, none of these lot, they're all useless. But as long as you've actually made your feelings known. So we asked this, and Simon said, it's my democratic right not to vote if I choose. Well, that's not, it's not. You have to register why. Because basically, Simon, you're just lazy, mate, aren't you? You're too bloody lazy to go and vote. So, no, you have to vote. Tony in Oz says, it's all the illusion of choice. Nothing ever changes. Well, if you put in none of the above or something similar, so that those people in politics now know that the majority of us think they're all a bunch of so-and-sos, then I think it would make a difference. What else we got here? Tom Amos. Hello, Tom. The prisoners demanding the right to vote must be after the compensation, not the... Well, yes, we know that, Tom. Why are you going on about this? I can't believe they're lying on their cell beds thinking, gee, I really wish I could vote in the election tomorrow. Yeah, Tom, we talked about that the other day, mate. Listen, will you listen to the programme properly, for goodness sake? You know, I'm asking whether you think voting should be compulsory. Here, oh dear. Tina, hello, Tina, says, yes, it should be compulsory. Then we would get a true democracy. It's madness that people who don't even use their vote moan and complain. I hope you're listening to this, Fleming, by the way. Moan and complain about the government and all their decisions, but don't take themselves to the polling stations to make their vote count. Tina, you're right. You're right. Let's do a couple more. Hugh says, definitely not. It's my right not to vote. No, it's not you. You know, you live in a democracy, mate. You know, if it wasn't a democracy, we might be in a civil war situation. We might be shooting at each other. We might be fighting each other because we disagree. Unfortunately, human beings are territorial and tribal, and democracy tries to give you a safe way to air our differences. And if people like you, and there's old Fleming up there as well, and he doesn't think you should vote, and quite a lot of you think, oh, I reserve my right not to take part. No, you're just lazy so-and-sos. You make sure you vote. At the moment, you have to choose some of the political parties. But if you want to be difficult, vote for one that you think is going to cause confusion. I mean, but you must vote. You must take part in the democracy. If there was 100% turnout, as there should be, then we have democracy.
They can always spoil the vote. That's still voting.
Yeah, I don't mind you doing that. You can do that as well, if you wish. Not a bad idea in some cases. But if you don't vote, then we don't have a democracy. We have a, I don't know what you call it, I suppose, a limited dictatorship. Because whoever's running the country is a minority of a minority. Because say we get a 70, 60, 70% turnout. And that would be quite high. And then the parties that won are a percentage of that smaller percent. It needs to be everybody votes. Otherwise, what is the point? Andy says, perhaps people exercising the right to not vote, the same people should forego the right to moan about it. Andy, I'm with you, mate. I think if you don't vote, then don't flipping phone me or write to me and moan. James, you should know, after how many years we don't have a democracy, they would be in trouble if we did. Well, the only reason we don't have a democracy, Paul, is because people don't take part in it. And if they did, we would. Now, look, I'm going on a bit here, aren't I? So shall we take a commercial break? And listen, if you haven't checked out my website, do. And you can do that at jamesworldradio.co.uk and follow our little links and pop into the shop. Buy yourself a T-shirt. The spring is coming. The days are getting lighter. Go and get yourself a Whaley T-shirt or Whaley hat. Very nice they are too, aren't they?
They are, yes.
Yeah, loads of stuff in there. So we'll take a break. And after that, let's come back and start my chat with Mr. Stringfellow.
Would you like a free audiobook? Our friends at Audible are giving everybody a free audiobook just by going to the James Whale Radio Show website, jamesworldradio.co.uk. All you need to do is click on the Audible link, register, and you'll get your free audiobook. It's a bit like a book club, and remember, you can leave at any time and you still get to keep your free audiobook. So what are you waiting for? Just head over to the James Whale Radio Show website, jamesworldradio.co.uk, and click on that Audible link now.
Peter Stringfellow has probably been one of my oldest friends. In fact, Peter, I can't remember when we first met, but it must be 20, 30 years ago, I think.
Well, if I remember, we were both serving the same jail sentence for armed robbery somewhere or other, and I helped you because I was a wonderful person in prison, but you were terrible, if I remember rightly. Anyway, when you got out, I got you a job. Do you remember that on radio? It was all down to me.
Yeah, no, and I'll always be very thankful. Always be very, very thankful. If people believe that, that's up to them, of course. The thing I like is that for years, I worked opposite where your club is in London.
Yeah.
And we spoke on the phone loads of times, but we hardly ever see each other.
And it's one of those things in life, isn't it, with friends. There's a lot of people you really, really want to bump into and you don't. And then, of course, there's the other side of the coin where you seem to be bumping into people and think, God, not again. But with you, and you know, especially your lovely Linda wife, are two of my best friends. And we don't see each other off enough, you're right. But It's seriously trying to remember when we first met, James. I can't, because I always seem to remember you was always famous and on radio. I can't quite... I remember doing a TV show with you. You did in the North. You did a TV show once, didn't you? Mm, and you invited me to go up there, which I did.
Let's go back to Yorkshire, where you first started. Peter Stringfellow started as a DJ in a nightclub. Now, I can't remember the name of the club. I think it was the Black Cat Club, or what was it called?
Well, you've got a good memory for names. It was called the Black Cat Club, but it wasn't really a nightclub. It was a church hall called St. Aidan's Church Hall that I ran every Friday night. And after a few weeks, I got these grandiose ideas and called it the Black Cat Club. But I mean, there's a great story attached to that. And I changed all the church windows every Friday and had to take all the lights out and put red lights in. And when it was finished at night, I had to take all the blinds back down from the church windows and put the regular lights back in. So really, you could say my first nightclub was a church.
What was the first thing that actually helped you break it? What took you from doing discos in a church hall, being the DJ, being the club manager, doing all the jobs yourself? What was your first break?
Two things. This may help people who ask me the question of, you know, how do you get started? How do you get from A to B, as I call it? How do you get from a church hall in Sheffield to where you are now as such? The answer to that is that I actually, first time I walked on the stage at my little church hall, I loved it immediately. I fell in love with the stage, the microphone, even though it was a terrible sound system that we could really hear me. We had one little spotlight, which was an old car headlight. And I just fell in love with the stage immediately and found out that that was my forte in life. But second to that, to what really made the difference, was booking a little-known band from Liverpool, listening to their first record called Love Me Do, and decided that I would book them and speak into their manager, whose name was Brian Epstein. Of course, I'm talking about the Beatles. So when the Beatles did play for me, a matter of 6 months after I'd started this church hall, I had to move from the church hall to a local ballroom. And the whole experience was incredibly exciting because the magic of the Beatles was real. Nothing can touch it today. It's not a matter of like an old man talking about the past. There was an incredible magic which can't be touched because it was all so new. And I went along with that magic and I introduced them on stage, met them, picked them up from the local hotel that they come on the train. And I put them on stage and introduced them and they were excited, four kids just like me. By the end of that night, no one had ever really heard them because the crowd were just screaming. And when everyone had left the ballroom and they'd left and I was stood there thinking, this is it, I want a lot more of this. And that was my major watershed change in life, I would say.
Did you ever want to be on the stage in a band yourself or not?
Are you crazy, James? Of course I did. In my brain, I was an up-and-coming rock god. But unfortunately, I couldn't sing. I can't hold a tune, I can't remember words, and that never changed. So the times I tried it, it was never going to go anywhere. I actually did make two acetates. Now, there's a name that nobody understands anymore, the test records. I made an acetate once of a number written by a friend of mine in Sheffield. It was called Look Into My Mirror. Being a Yorkshire guy, I had to say mirror instead of mirror. And that never got made because it was awful. And then the second one, you've got to believe the title. This was in the later, in the middle to late 60s. It was called You Must Be Joking. And that was the title. And I was seriously trying to sing that. You must be joking. Da, 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 da. It was very much a Herman's Hermit kind of thing for that era, for the 60s. And that never got released, thank God. But I was so wrapped up with so many big up-and-coming names, and I was involved with their talent. Their talent was so fantastic, and I realised that they'd got it, and I got no talent. So that's why I stuck with promoting and went to nightclubs. And I got my kick from, as I still do, around like with a microphone, it's like super glue to my mouth. You can't get it off me.
No, I know. And of course, the flamboyant costumes that you wear, the fact that you are a personality, and this is something that the promoters and the club owners of the time didn't often do, did they?
No, I always remember that I did them in Sheffield. We'd just got the Black Cat Club. I'd opened another church hall, St. John's, and I called it the Blue Moon Club. And by now I was booking some who became pretty big names, the Kinks. I booked them on their first record, Yeah, You Really Got Me Now. And the Hollies, of course, and their first record, The Searchers, there for a little known singer called Rod Stewart, who was a second singer with the Hoochie Coochie Men. Another little band from Liverpool called the Midnighters, whose lead singer was a guy called Freddie Starr. Not many people know that Freddie started off as a kind of inverted pop rock singer with his own band. And I did all that kind of stuff. And then one day I decided to put on a show at the Sheffield City Hall with all the top Sheffield names, and that was the Cadillacs. Listen, for a Sheffield group, Johnny Tempest and the Cadillacs, was that a great name? Dave Berry and the Cruisers, Dean Martin and Dean Martin and the Marshalls. Oh, and the Dean Marshall and the Deputies, Johnny Silver and the Thunderbirds. He wrote Sheffield names, and I put them on, and I called it "Thank Your Lucky Stars." In other words, I was stealing a name from a from a radio show. But the point of this story is that when I put the program together, I put the photograph of myself and my brother on the front. And I always remember Dave Berry was the biggest name in Sheffield and still is, saying to me, "I've been around a couple of years," and he might have meant a couple of years, "but I've never seen a program with the promoter's photograph on the front and not the star." And to me, I looked at him, I thought, well, I'm doing all this. I'm the one putting it together. I'm going to be on stage, my photograph on the front. And that was the attitude I took forward, Jade. That was the attitude I went with. It wasn't like these stars are way above me. I was one of them in my head, but I realized that they were true stars and true talented people. And I just kind of was in their wake, if you know what I mean, and hanging around. I once sang on stage with Benny King, when first time he ever came to England with Stand By Me after the Drifters. And he let me right at the end, because that was my game, to try and get on with the stars at end and sing along for their encore. And he let me sing Stand By Me, boom. And he kept saying, "Okay, Peter, Stand By Me," on stage, all the crowd in front. And all of a sudden I turned around and he'd left the stage. And I was on the stage on my own. Of course, it collapsed and that was the end of that. And I said to him, "What'd you do that for?" And he said, "There's no way you're going to get off." and that went on. I once played harmonica with Keith Rolfe of the original Yardbirds. And he let me go on stage and he taught me how to suck and blow a key of C mouth organ. I went around for weeks after that thinking I could play the mouth organ, which of course I couldn't. You know? But these are all fun little stories attached to my life. I was having such a great time, and still do, James. You know, I enjoy my life immensely. But yeah, mixing with the raw talent as it was then and seeing it come forward, I introduced the Rolling Stones on stage at Sheffield when I booked them. And I went to say hello to Mick Jagger and Brian Jones, and they were deep in conversation. Not one of them would talk to me. I remember that. I was a bit deflated because, after all, I was Peter Stringfellow. And my mother knew who I was. I'm surprised that they didn't know. But that went through. And I also, a little story, when I introduced them on Ready, Steady, Go, I was there for a little while. I was a warm-up guy and compared on Ready, Steady, Go. And I organized the audience to rush the stage after the Rolling Stones had just played their hit at the time called Paint It Black, you know. Yeah. Paint It Black, which is still one of my favorites, with the sitar sound in it. And I remember jumping on stage, trying to get in front of the cameras and putting my foot through Brian Jones' sitar and smashed it. It was never played again. And so my second meeting with Brian Jones was to tell him I've just destroyed his sitar. So, of course, he didn't talk to me again. So I met him twice. He never spoke to me once. But that was the era that I was playing around in. Everything was so naive and so new. And that was probably what was so wonderful about that time. He wasn't following anybody, he hadn't got anybody to. They did it, so I would do it. You did it your own way. And it took me many, many years to get to what I would say a success recognition level. But during that period of building up, I had a fantastic time.
When did you first move to London and open your nightclub?
1980. The club opened August 1980, which means that this August this year, Stringfellows will have been open 35 years, which is now because Annabelle's is moving. Also, Annabelle's changed its ownership some while back to Richard Caring, as you probably know. Johnny Gold sold a tramp some years ago. And of course, Louis Brown died some years ago with the old Valbonne, which left me. So I'm the one standing, the oldest nightclub runner in London, with the exception probably, although he wasn't always in nightclubs as long as me, and that was the guy who's still around called Oscar, who owns the Windmill Gentlemen's Club down the road from me in Soho. Lovely character. I saw him the other day in a black-on-black Bentley. You've got to give it to him. What a character. But it leaves me, which I'm very proud of, to be the longest-standing nightclub owner in the UK. Probably the world.
Now, talking about the world, Peter, of course, you opened up one of your clubs in America, but that wasn't so successful, was it?
Well, there's always a story attached, James, as you well know. My first club was New York Stringfellows in 1985. I think it was, and it was a success. It was a great, and I've spent a great deal of money on it, and much more money than I really had. So once we got it going. Then I opened one in Miami, which was an incredibly successful club in Coconut Grove, anybody who knows that area, the Mayfair Gallery area. That was incredibly wonderful, glamorous nightclubs. I've always liked to build glamorous, beautiful places. There was the 1990s, recessions came in America and started affecting London. I'm sorry, New York. Then it went down to Miami. By then, I was halfway building my first club in L.A., Beverly Hills, which cost another phenomenal amount of money, another $5 million in that era. By the time I got that open, the recession in America was full-blooded. Also, America went to war with Iraq for the first time, and which was called the Desert?
Desert Storm.
Desert Storm, thank you, James. So, I know, my timing wasn't exactly perfect. So those three clubs wobbled all over the place, but the silver lining came to my help and rescue, because I was in Miami and I first saw the girl business, as I call it, the gentleman's club with girls on stage taking the clothes off and guys watching this and having a super time. And I thought, I'll do that. So I took the whole image up to New York. But in the meantime, I had to close Miami down. The Beverly Hills was incredibly successful for 18 months, full of superstars, film stars, but I made no money, because film stars don't spend money. You give it to them. One of my little stories, when Clint Eastwood came in the club, and him and Charlie Sheen was at the bar, and they had a lager each. Now, how the hell do you give Clint Eastwood a bill for two bloody lagers? You don't. But that's how it was over there. The stars came in. Sylvester Stallone nearly lived in the place, but he was always surrounded by girls, a couple of bottles of champagne. But no massive sales. So that eventually closed. I was left with New York as a girl club. Phenomenally successful, but by then I was in trouble financially in America. I had to sell my interest in that club and come and regroup myself back into the good old Stringfellows, London. That's when I brought in the girl business that I'd been so successful with in New York. As they say, the history starts yet again. That was in 1996. I acquired the license to do Stringfellows, London. And I've been a girl club ever since, which is phenomenally successful, and thank goodness for that.
A lot of celebrities quite like to be photographed coming out of Stringfellows and going in. Do they still like to be photographed, or has ever since the problems with the news of the world and everything else, has that stopped?
Oh, yeah. It stopped a while back, James. In the 80s, if you come into my offices, you'll see black and white photographs, mainly from the 80s and the early 90s, stars coming in. I would point to the 80s, which the stars would come in and have a lot of fun themselves, have a few drinks, get nicely drunk, and probably pull each other, and then go out of the club and have the photographs taken. You name the star, they had the photographs taken, coming out of Stringfellows, coming out of Langham's, coming out of Tramps, not necessarily out of Annabelle's at that time, because Annabelle's wasn't so much a star hangout as an aristocratic hangout, you know. I was there once when Prince Charles was dancing at the side of me. So that was the Annabelle's. The other clubs like mine, where the stars and film stars would come in. No, you don't see Jack Nicholson anymore, but he used to always pop into London String Pullers when he was in the clubs, when he was in London. There is an old-style celebrity, let's have a lot of fun, seems to have gone. Colin Farrell would probably be the last film star I've seen in String Pullers for a while. We got a lot of sports stars now. As I said a little earlier, I haven't heard enough of Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye sitting on String Pullers piano jamming away. You don't get that anymore. I think what it is, the internet has changed the whole world. I think the internet now, people accessing the internet, the social media, which I just can't get my head around. No, I'm not on Twitter, by the way. I don't know if you are, but I'm not. You know, I don't see, in my opinion, at my age, it doesn't seem to attract me at all. So the whole game that you asked, has it changed dramatically? If you look in the newspapers now, very rarely, the only time you're going to see film stars, if they go into their own film premieres, you know, all that seems to have gone. I don't think there is a nightclub where the stars actually go to entertain themselves.
Do you think a new String Fellow could now emerge? Is it a different time? Is it possible for another flamboyant entrepreneur in an entertainment sphere to come along, do you think?
Yeah, of course there is. There's always another String Fellow hanging around. So when I came from the North England and kicked doors down to get into London and kicked doors down when I was in London, changed the way that nightclubs was perceived. My attitude when I came to London was, if you look good enough, you can come in. I don't care who you are, but you've got to look good. And that was as opposed to Trump and the other clubs going, you've got to be somebody to get in here.
You can't do that anymore, can you? You can't say to somebody, sorry, you're far too ugly. You're not coming. No, you're too fat. You're not coming in here.
No, that's all gone. No, I got the front page of the bloody Sun some years in the 80s, because just like every other celebrity nightclub, you were looking for pretty, beautiful people. And I turned, sadly, before anybody starts writing off and twittering like mad about me, I turned down a couple of fat ladies, because not just because they were fat, they weren't dressed. And I tried to make the point that fat people, like anyone else, if you want to come in my club, you've got to look glamorous, you know. And anyway, this one put me on front page, String Fellow. Bands, fat people. Well, my God, the world went mad for 3 weeks. So we played the game in the early days, and now people know how to dress to get into nightclubs. And a lot of the young people, I was thinking the other day, nobody needs Prada anymore. Let's be honest, they don't need Versace. The young, beautiful people don't need anything that costs us fortunes. Go to Topshop, buy a couple of nice outfits. Good-looking people look good, whatever they're wearing.
It's never been a drawback to me, TK Maxx all the way. I must put this on record. I don't know if I've said this publicly before, but when I was very ill, you know, I had cancer 15 years ago. In fact, 15 years ago to this week, in fact, I had my operation. And after that, I was on a radio station called Talk Radio, which later became Talk Sport. And you remember my wife used to bring me into your clubs after I finished my show quite regularly. And we'd sit down and we'd have dinner with you. And then we had to tell Mrs. W to stop trying to become a pole dancer herself.
I have to say that when I first brought it in 1996, I actually danced on the pole once. Much, much harder than it looks.
Do you, talking about that, do you ever regret the photograph of you on the beach in the thong?
Listen, there is two photographs of me on the beach in the thong. There was one where my ass looks incredible as I'm walking up the beach, so keep on putting that on. But the second one where I'm bending down with a stupid G-string and my belly hanging out. And my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, at the side of me yawning, I'd like to see that one destroyed if possible. Do I regret it? No, it just all makes me laugh now. It's not a regret.
I met Margaret Thatcher in a completely different surroundings. I interviewed Margaret Thatcher a few times, like hundreds, thousands of other people did. But I don't reckon that many people ever sat down in String Fellows and spoke to Margaret Thatcher. What was it about her that you liked so much?
What I liked about her, she was straight talking, but she was what's missing today. People talk about my two favourite words, and even a lady uses it without knowing what they're saying. That's inspiration and aspiration. She was an inspiration because she truly was, say, middle class, coming from a grocery store, father on a grocery store. That's an inspiration to me, that someone at that level, via their own and education good, came to be the Prime Minister of Great Britain and stood her ground alongside with Ronald Reagan in the Cold War. No, I wasn't a big fan of going to war to the Falklands. You know, I was a bit of a wimp in that, you know, let them have it. That was my attitude, let Argentina have it. But by the time of it, she'd been there and our forces had got the thing back. Falklands belonged to us. You know, you couldn't help but have that feeling of pride that Thatcher had stood her ground and put it right. And then after that, she sorted it out. Private enterprise was the flag that she would wave. And aspiration for people who aspire to be better than what they've got now. And that was Margaret Thatcher. She inspired aspiration in people. She certainly inspired aspiration in me. The time she met me, there was no toffee-nose stuff about it. We spoke. In fact, it was her that demanded I got married to Bella. She'd met Bella before, and then we met again at Geoffrey Archer's party. He lives above me when I live here. It was great. And she said, "Have you not married this beautiful girl yet?" And I went, no, not yet. She would get on with it. And that's how she spoke, of course. And I thought, "Oh, bloody hell, she's right. I better get married." And I did. But the aspiration of that lady, I'm still looking for today. You know, there's a lot of excuses made with politics. I don't know anybody, maybe, I don't think you do. Is anybody out there that wants a lesser life than they've got? Is anybody wants a cheaper car? Does anybody want no holidays? Is anybody out there wants a lesser house than they've got? Less food to eat than they've got? To aspire to a better life is second nature to me. And the politics that helps me and helps people around and helps our voters and the UK people to aspire to a better life means that you don't go mad with taxes. Don't take away the energy by overtaxing people. Bring the taxes down, the economy will boom. It's so simple. And everybody, there's such a thing as a trickle-down economy. You take less taxes off me, I'll pay more taxes in more bills in restaurants and various things which goes to other people. She did put those council houses up for sale. A lot of people did buy them. A lot of people to this day are sitting on council houses now that they could sell for a lot more than they ever bought them for. And that, to me, is a damn good thing for those people.
Why did so many people dislike her?
Well, there is that little thing behind a lot of people, envy and straight-talking people. They want to hear something. I don't know if you met Nigel Farage. I like Nigel. But Nigel tells you what you want to hear because Nigel knows he's never going to be in a position to have to put that forward. So a lot of people like fairy stories. They like to listen to a fairy story that all ends up wonderful and we're all going to be richer and there's never going to be nobody come to Great Britain that's not professionally qualified and that nobody's going to get taxed anymore and everybody's going to be very, very happy and we're all going to go to the pub and drink beer. That is never, ever, ever going to happen. We have to live in the world we're in. And therefore, I'm looking for the person that tells us the truth. And I think we've got that with George Osborne. We certainly haven't got it with Ed Miliband. Ed's another one that's telling you what you want to hear because he's not in power. And then if he does, and there's a chance he will, which I hope not, but if the UK people decide to vote Labour in, then they'll have to live with the consequences. In my opinion, Conservatives is the nearest one to what we're looking for, and that's an aspirational population to live a better life.
Do you think if you had your time again, and now with the benefit of hindsight, Peter, do you think you would have gone into politics?
I was never smart enough to do that, James. I'm not patronising anybody here, and certainly not myself. And I'm not self-depreciation. I'm telling you the truth. I like the idea that our leaders have been to Eton or Oxford and Cambridge. These are smart people. They've got to be in this world that we live in now. For all, I left school at 15. to this day, I'm not smart enough to be a top-line politician. I'm just not. I've got my views, I've got my ideas. But to lead a country, no. I'm very happy that we do have highly educated people on all parties. And that includes Nigel Farage, who plays it down, but he's a well-educated man. The Liberals have got more than their share. Nick Clegg, who I think sometimes gets incredibly lost as a naive boy, nevertheless, a well-educated boy. I don't know who runs the Greens, but they're no doubt the same thing. So I don't feel that I am personally clever. I'm smart, and I've learned on the way up. Take me back 20 years, I was not as smart as I am now. So politics, good idea to say, yeah, I could have gone into politics. But like anything else, if I want to go into it, I want to be the top dog. And if I went into politics, there was no way I was going to be made prime minister. So I wouldn't have been too happy. I like to do what a lot of people do. Stand on the side and tell the guys who are doing it what to do. And then I go and do what I want to do. And that's a touch of honesty for you.
I'm going to ask you this question and think and tell me the answer to this. Your daughter is how old now?
18 months.
All right. If when she's 22, 23, she wanted to work as an angel in one of your clubs, what would you say?
Well, if I could still speak in 22 years' time, I'd be so happy. I'd be going up 100 years old, James. Thanks very much for that. You've made my day. My view is this, that I will educate my daughter as best I can. I will give her the views of the world the best I can. My wife will continue to do that. And then when she's 22, she will make her own decisions on whatever she wants to do in life. And if she wished to be an angel of a club similar to mine, that would be her decision. But I would, in the early days, try and guide her towards being a scientist. I don't want her to marry into royalty, football, rock stars, nothing. I'd like her to have her own education, hopefully go to Cambridge, Oxford, something similar to that, maybe even the Sheffield University, which is rated highly, and come out and be a scientist. I'd love that. But if she wants to be a dancer, so be it.
Peter, we could talk a lot longer, but we've run out of time. Every time I talk to you on the phone, I say, well, listen, let's get together soon and have something to eat and a drink. And if we manage to in the next year, I'll be very happy. Peter, you are an inspiration. I love you. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye, James. Bye-bye.
Sitting in my room and I'm on my own. It's cold outside and I'm feeling alone. So I turn that dial and my radio's on. I hear James Whale and my troubles are gone. I hear James Whale on the radio. I hear James Whale and his podcast show. I hear James Whale on the radio.
Tech Talk becoming an ever so popular feature on the James Whale Radio Show, where Rob, my producer, who is he's a maestro of the tech.
That's a really appalling car, isn't it?
Ah, yeah, showing your age. Yeah, used to be, didn't it? Yes, horrible car. But anyway, can we do Tech Talk
now? I'm just concerned that I'm going to be called the Rust Bucket of Tech.
Yeah, the Rust Bucket of Tech. What we need is a jingle. We need a jingle for that. Actually, if anybody'd like to sponsor Tech Talk, get in touch, baby, get in touch. Right. Now, apparently you've got an interview with Kim Jong-un, is that right? Now, you've got to be fairly careful here. We've got the Russians sniffing around as it is.
You know about the film The Interview?
Oh, yeah, I know, yeah, and look what's happened.
Yeah, well, now somebody's made an app called The Little Dictator, and originally it was pulled off the Apple store, but it's coming back, and it's basically Kim Jong-un flying on a little rocket, and he's got to avoid nuclear missiles, otherwise he blows up.
You know, it's a really good point. Well, we talked about democracy, weren't we, just now? You don't have democracy and you get the wrong person. You get some nutcase like him in power. And he's conning an entire country.
He is, in a way.
I mean, you know, that country thinks the rest of the world is totally against them. And if you disagree with him, he takes you out and shoots you.
So, you know, after they did the interview, everyone got threatened if they tried to watch it and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm thinking it might be bad for all our phones are going to stop working because the North Koreans are going to hack everyone's phone.
Look, Rob, yeah. You are a past master at all that sort of thing. Mm. I just have to give the word, clip my fingers, and you can bring down all their technical support, can't you?
Well, yeah, well maybe.
Come on, you know you can.
Shall I do it as a little project, see if we can bring down North
Korea? Why don't
Korea?
We just close down North Korea?
Okay, I'll make some notes.
Make some notes. Close down North Korea. Because I'm not going to be spoken to or told how to behave by, what is he, 22-year-old with a bad haircut.
Uh-huh. Okay, 22-year-old bad haircut. Okay, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. The Little Dictator.
That's the game, yeah. You can download that soon.
The little tiddly dictator.
We're getting into all sorts of trouble now. But
are we?
Yeah, it's a bit like Flappy Birds, the game. A popular game, Flappy Birds. So I can imagine it's going to be a very popular game.
Well, I think it probably will. And that's a finger up to Kim Jong-un by playing it. Is that it, then?
Finger.
That's your tech
up.
Talk today, is it?
Yeah, I'm just making notes. Finger up, Kim Jong-un.
Up. Yeah. Yeah. Now, do you know the track we had last week?
Yeah.
Our friendly DJ, Tony Fisher, he got in touch with him. He loved that bit of music.
We have good music on every now and again.
We do have very good music. I've had a lot of people ask if we could play last week's track again sometime.
We can do that.
We can play more from their album. I think they've got more, haven't they?
That Jake Morley, if I remember rightly.
Yeah. Let's stick with this week's. If you want to be on the show, if you've got a band or you make music and you think it's good enough to be on the show, get in touch with us, jamesweil@gmail.com, isn't it?
No. None
isn't
of those.
It?
No.
Why don't I just look at the top of the bit of paper where it'll tell me, jamesweilradio@gmail.com, it
that's,
is.
That's the one, yeah.
What did I say?
jamesweil@gmail.com. This jamesweil@gmail.com must get hammered with emails.
Yeah, we should have got that email, shouldn't we?
Well, there is more than one James Whale, unfortunately. I don't like to be the one that tells you.
There is not. I am the only one. There used to be another one, but he died in a swimming pool, a rather tragic end. Right, listen, jamesweilradio@gmail.com if you think you should be on the program giving us some music. Today, Men with Ven, V-E-N, and this track, which is available on iTunes, is called The Misses.
The church bells rang, the choir sang, and I swear my heart went bang when the vicar said she was the missus. I looked at her, she looked at me. I knew right away she would always be undeniably the missus. To have and to hold until we both grow old, she will always be the missus. Through indiscretions and repossessions and the odd cancelling session, she has never stopped being the missus. For richer, for poorer, I'll always adore her. I love her, 'cause she's the missus. Till death us do part, she'll always have me heart. If there's one thing I'm sure of, this is she always was, she'll always be a part of me eternally. I can guarantee forever the missus. Yeah, she's the missus. She'll never stop being the missus.
Did you read earlier this week that you can now eat fat?
You can now eat fat?
Yeah. Well, you heard that the doctor said that, you know, eating butter, eggs, cheese is not perhaps as bad for you as they thought it was.
I love butter. I don't like this low-fat spread stuff.
Not good for you. I don't think it's good for you. I don't think you should. I've never eaten it. I don't think it's good for you. And lots of people responding on that. Sandy says, I'm saddened by this as I eat a lot of cheese, butter and drink loads of milk. Now I'm going to have to blame it on something else. Does anybody know if real ale is fattening or red wine? Yeah, I think it's fattening. I don't suggest, Sandy, you eat it, nothing else. But anyway, Mark Pearson says, marvellous to reflect that government information has been the single biggest contributor to the incredible rise in type 2 diabetes in the UK since they announced that fats were bad and carbs were okay. And Shelley says, the oncoming storm. Oh, right. It was always sugar that was bad for you, but the government has so many companies that make sugary content funding them, they couldn't say the truth. Sugar is a poison to put in the body, as we are not equipped to process it in the amounts we consume. Well, don't eat it. I don't have sugar. I mean, I know, listen, I did a thing for Inside Out, BBC Inside Out last year, about how much sugar, hidden sugar, there is in things. But if you look, if you, as we say, shop smart, read the labels of what you're buying, you can find out. Make sure you get sugarless baked beans. There's loads of sugar in baked beans, by the way. What else have we got? Greta says, my mother-in-law had fat all her life and she lived to the ripe old age of 94. Kay says, I eat fats, but good ones. And my cholesterol's only 3.3, so it does no harm. And Jackie Ingalls says, yeah, good news. Now, where are those donuts? Don't think the donuts are going to be quite as good for you, I must confess. I think we're almost out of time, aren't we, really?
No time for questions.
Yeah, I want to do the questions. So we've got loads of other things we're going to do, but questions. So you asked, people have been emailing and Facebooking and tweeting in questions. This is how we end the show, by the way. If you're a new listener, get out there and tell your friends. Join us right here, wherever it is you're listening to us. It could be on Talent GB. They put us out. iTunes put us out. Just go to our website, jameswhaleradio.co.uk. And, of course, as soon as the program's available, it's tweeted out all over the place. You can share the link with your friends. Or right here on the radio station you're listening to us on.
Okay, so ready for questions?
I am. I'm sitting here, got my feet up on my desk.
Okay.
Got my cup of tea in hand. Oh, I finished it. Right. Must be near the end of the programme if I finish my tea. Come on.
David Wilson, Katie Hopkins, is she fake or real?
She's obviously a real person. And people have said, would we get her on the programme? And we are trying. She's a bit frightened of me. If you want to tweet Katie Hopkins and try and encourage her to be a guest on this show, feel free. Is Katie Hopkins real or fake? I think the character that she likes to portray is probably not as real as she thinks.
That's a deep answer.
That was a good answer. Mm. That's a pretty answer. Pretty good answer. Yeah.
Mark Hudson, do hairs on a gooseberry stop it from being a grape?
No. What stops a gooseberry? I'm glad you asked me that. It's quite an important question, actually. What stops a gooseberry being a grape is actually the taste.
Okay. Ed Owens, is oral sex something you talk about?
No.
Neil Adams, will man ever walk on the sun?
What was this cretin's name?
Neil Adams.
You're not even bloody funny. Go away.
You can't walk on the sun. It's just gas.
Don't even have to tell him that. He's an idiot.
Oh, okay. Ruth,
I don't like idiots anymore. I've decided, and the sooner you know, your story the other week, you know, about the racist thugs in Paris pushing a black guy off the train was in all the papers. You probably didn't see it because you don't really know what's going on. But I think front page of the Sun said they should be found and they should all be jailed. I think hanging would probably be too good, but they certainly need to be ridiculed. And the sooner they're found and the sooner they're dealt with. In fact, when you're listening to this, because people listen to this program at all times, they may well have been caught. They may well, and I hope they are, and I hope they get what they deserve. To be quite honest, disgusting, despicable people. Sorry, next question.
Roof Ashton, do you believe that humans are really meant to eat meat? I've just watched the Horizon programme proving that red meat is bad for us.
Yeah, I don't believe any of these programmes. I think, you know, we are omnivores. That there is no question about it, that we are omnivores. But I do think that we eat too much meat. I think that there is too much cruelty involved in the killing of meat. We were supposed to be, you know, we come from hunters, don't we, and gatherers. And you would not have, if you had to go out and hunt your own meat, you wouldn't have been eating as much meat as we do now. And the other thing I think we should do is meat should be more, much, much more expensive than it is. And we should eat less of it. All right. It shouldn't be, you know, oh, I can't afford it. It should be, well, I can only afford a certain amount of meat. And in butchers, as they used to be, you used to see what the animal was. In supermarkets, and I blame a lot of you out there for this, you like to see meat as something vacuum-packed and plastic, which looks about as far removed from a living thing as it can be. I think you need to know that you are eating a living thing. So whether it's a fish, whether it's a chicken, whether it's a cow, a pig, a sheep, a goat, whatever it is you're eating, I think there must be respect for the animal that's given their life so that you can eat it. Come on, get with the questions.
Well, that's it. I've run out of questions.
Was that all? Well, I need some more for next week. Can you get a few more on for next week?
Oh, I've got one. Here's one. I've got one.
Go on. Never mind run out of questions. We've run out of time, actually. Go on. Okay, one more quickie.
Barry Wooding. Why is the truth about religion never mentioned, i.e. it's a mental illness?
Well, that's a pretty stupid thing to say, because you have no idea whether religion is real or not. Who knows? I mean, that's as bad as actually saying, I absolutely believe. How can any of us believe? We don't know. I mean, if you have a belief, then you're very lucky, I suppose. I tell you what it could be. Perhaps that's the makeup of a human being. We're supposed to have this belief because we're all frightened of dying. But I think saying religion's a mental illness is just slightly facile, if I could say. Well, hopefully we haven't offended too many people on the programme today. I don't think so. If you missed last week's programme, Deborah Meaden was my guest. And if you go back to the website, jamesworldradio.co.uk, there are, 70 odd hours?
Yep.
Of the James Whale Radio Show, with all sorts of great guests from I can't think of the moment. Boy George is on there.
He is, yes.
Jeffrey Archer. Now, when that program went out, we had a lot of people say, "Well, why did you talk to Jeffrey Archer? Well, he's an interesting person, a person who'll be remembered in history." And I just remember that because Stringfellow mentioned the fact that he lives in the same block of flats. So. There we are, just something for you to go and have a little listen to. I think we've even got a programme with Nigel Farage on, haven't we?
We have, yes.
Yeah. So, thank you very much indeed for tuning this way. James Whale will be back with you, same time, same place, as you have now. And if in the meantime you want to listen to some of the other shows, please fill your boots.
I'm off to the chippy now.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have a curry.
James Whale Radio Show. For more information, visit www.jameswhaleradio.co.uk. Why not check us out on facebook.com/JamesWhaleRadioShow or follow James on Twitter @TheJamesWhale. James Whale, the voice of reason.